loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. Democrats and Republicans in the Senate have come to an agreement to end the government shutdown, which had entered its third day. The Democrats are declaring victory because they received the promise of a vote in February on DACA. But is this not only a defeat for the Democratic Party, but a huge setback for the immigrant community and for the Dreamers? Next, Turkish forces have captured the Syrian city of Afrin on the third day of an offensive to oust Syrian Kurdish fighters from the border.
And in our second hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the NSA has deleted surveillance data, and the FBI has deleted text messages between two FBI employees criticizing President Trump that a judge had ordered them to preserve. NSA said disingenuously that it didn't have the storage space to hold the data. The FBI said the deletion was an accident. Next, Twitter on Friday began emailing more than 677,000 people to tell them that they may have interacted with several thousand accounts that Twitter has linked to a Russian bot farm. What was in the automated tweets, and did they sway voters or opinion makers during the election? Then the United States is arming and training neo-Nazis in Ukraine, all while Congress is debating a prohibition on doing just that. And then, just days after the Trump administration announced that it would allow states to compel poor people to work in order to get health care under Medicaid, federal health officials granted Kentucky permission to impose those requirements. And finally, President Trump's new national defense strategy envisions a world where great power competition with China and Russia is a bigger threat to the U.S. than terrorism. Have we entered into a new national defense era? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the government shutdown. Democrats and Republicans in the Senate have come to an agreement to end the government shutdown, which had entered its third day. The Democrats are declaring victory because they received the promise of a vote in February on DACA. But is this really a loss for the Democratic Party and for the immigrant rights community and for immigrant families? We are joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese, the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can see his writings at popularresistance.org. And we are joined from New York City by Angie Kim. She is an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Min Kwan Center for Community Action. She herself is a dreamer. Angie Kim, how are you feeling right now?
Well, first, thanks for having me on the show again. Good to hear from you on such a terrible day. It's hard to describe how I feel. I mean, I'm extremely disappointed. There's definitely an anger and also sadness that I'm sharing with my community and fellow dreamers and my undocumented family. So this is a terrible, terrible outcome, and my hearts go out to all the dreamers and undocumented families who might be tuning in and listening right now.
Kevin Zeese, same to you.
Well, we have 17 days till the next shutdown, and that's 17 days, I think, when the dreamer community and supporters and allies need to really step up and keep the pressure on. You know, on February 8th, this agreement runs out, and the circumstances might be very well the same. And that's the time that we have to try to win this. It's going to be difficult because Paul Ryan in the House has not agreed to anything. Donald Trump has not agreed to anything. And all we have in the Senate is that it'll get to the floor. We don't know how that's going to play out or, be voted on. So it's still a tough battle, but it is a battle with a time limit. We need to really make some moves now.
You know what? That's exactly the point that I wanted to make, too. The same point that Kevin Zeese just made. All the Democrats got out of this was Mitch McConnell's promise of a floor debate on immigration. Donald Trump never made such a promise, and neither did Paul Ryan. So there is, I would venture to say, very little likelihood that the Democrats are going to end up with anything tangible coming out of this vote. It's just words from Mitch McConnell. And indeed, the New York Times is saying now in an article that was just posted in the last few minutes that The Democrats actually had to debate within their own conference as to whether or not they should even trust McConnell's word. They didn't even discuss Ryan and Trump. Kevin Zeese, you think there's any chance of real immigration reform, or even not even reform, just movement forward on immigration?
I do. I've been very impressed with the actions of the people fighting for Dreamers and the Dreamers themselves. It's been a really impressive effort, and I really think they have incredible capacity that to put pressure on both chambers of the Congress and can actually win this. So I'm not counting it out. I realize the politics of leadership in Capitol Hill has serious problems, but it's not really what they do, it's what we do that will make the decision. And, you know, Paul Ryan has kind of done this to the Democrats before when in 2013 they passed immigration reform in the Senate, and then he didn't do anything in the House. So we know what we're dealing with in the House. And so that's where the pressure really has to be put. It's on Trump and Ryan. And I think we're going to win. I think we're going to win in the Senate, but we still have to fight in the House and in the White House.
Angie Kim, back to you. You know, the country in general, if you look at the polls, is very, very sympathetic to DACA and to Dreamers. And the polls also show the population, with the exception of the Republican Party, and really a segment of the Republican Party, find the building of a wall at the U.S.-Mexican border to be something they don't support. So you have an unpopular war, an unpopular wall versus a popular presentation for DACA. So you would think the Democrats would have a relatively strong hand if they were also against the wall and for the Dreamers. In other words, getting additional relief for the Dreamers after President Trump, using executive order, ended that relief. But they didn't do that. They were all about building the wall suddenly. I mean, the whole pitch was, yeah, let's build a wall. I'm looking at a statement from Representative Luis Gutierrez, congressperson from Illinois, and he's been right there and in the streets with the Dreamers. And here's what he said about this. I think it would be, this was a couple days ago, I think it would be a monumental waste of taxpayers' money to build a monument to stupidity, that is the wall. But if that's what it's going to take to get 800,000 young men and women and give them a chance to live freely and openly in America, then I'll roll up my sleeves. I'll go down there with bricks and mortar and begin the wall, because a brick for lives. Okay, let's do it. Let me just say, the wall is offensive to me. It is insulting to me. This is Gutierrez still. And people like me who have come to the country. But you know, people of my generation will do what they have to do, because this is what we do for the younger people. Angie Kim, you are one of those younger people. You came as a 9-year-old, I believe. You've been here a long time. How do you react to Gutierrez's statement?
Well, it was definitely controversial. So let me just make this very clear. And I understand that one of the pitfalls of these, you know, ongoing debate and conversations that are happening in Capitol Hill, what it does is it completely confuses the narrative and the message. Our messaging is always clear. We do not support a wall. We do not believe in a border wall, and nor does majority of the Americans and both parties. Frankly, it's a waste of money and it's a waste of time. But the wall, really, what it was, it symbolizes the compromise between the both parties. And, you know, Senator Schumer made this very clear when he pitched his messaging and his speech on the floor during this whole, the last couple, you know, 72 what hours, is that he saw the wall as a compromise to move this process forward. He talked about having a private meeting with President Trump, where he offered the wall that President Trump ran his campaign on and he so endearingly loved. But Senator Gutierrez's message should definitely not be received where he's championing for a border wall. Our undocumented communities don't believe in that. But if, it is a compromise in order to protect the 11 million people who are vulnerable, including the Dreamers, who are about 3 million population out of the 11. So I just want to, you know, I think it's important to keep the focus on, you know, our messaging and our goal, which is that we want a comprehensive immigration reform, and protecting Dreamers should have been a part of that. But obviously we have seen, and what has unraveled is that the politicians are now using these deal makers and breakers, such as Dreamers and DACA program, as a bargaining chip for something bigger and larger. And the way I see it is that the Republicans want some type of a Republican version of a comprehensive immigration reform in exchange for a protection for the Dreamers, which should never have been a part of the conversation in the first place. Every American believes that the Congress, the White House, should do the right thing, which is to protect these young undocumented Dreamers, period. There's no argument buts or ifs there. And we have another issue that we need to resolve, which is, you know, our broken immigration system. But you know, the politicians have done this job, which is they seem to be so good at, which is meshing all these issues and problems into a bigger mess.
That's the voice of Angie Kim. She's an immigrant rights advocate and a community organizer with the Min Kwan Center for Community Action. She herself is a Dreamer. She came to the United States as a young child. She's lived here for a couple decades. She, along with 800,000 to 1 million people, will lose all protection and be subject to deportation once again unless something happens to overturn President Trump's executive order that canceled the DACA program. That was the deferred action for childhood arrival. Deferred action meaning don't deport them. They're not breaking the law. They're not engaged in criminal activity. They came as kids, some of them as babies. They're working. They're going to school. There's no reason to punish them. So President Obama, under pressure from the Dreamers, from grassroots pressure, from civil disobedience, and unable to get comprehensive immigration reform passed, used his executive powers to put a DACA into place. President Trump came in and undid that. Now we have a government shutdown that's become a non-shutdown. And the issue, again, as a political football, is maybe on the table, but not directly on the table. It's been tabled, in effect, and it won't come up for at least a couple of days, maybe a couple of weeks. Kevin Zeitz, there's two issues to in my mind that I want to have both you and Angie discuss, or there's so many issues, but two in particular. One is the Democrats, there's the ethical, moral question, which is it's wrong to, you know, to build a wall just because Donald Trump wants to satisfy a campaign pledge, to spend $18 billion to $33 billion so we can say he did it. The wall isn't going to do anything positive. It's only going to do negative things. It's going to have a lot of people die in the desert. It's going to poison relations between the U.S. and Mexico. It demonizes Mexican and Latino people from that region. There's another question, too, which is why do the Democrats, under these circumstances, where the wall is unpopular and DACA is popular, why do they start the process off on their back foot, on their back heel? Why are they always saying from the beginning, even when they have the wind at their backs in terms of public opinion, we're ready to compromise, where you have right-wing Republicans who are never ready to compromise? If President Obama had said the sun rises in the east and says, and said it sets in the West, the Republicans would say, no, it doesn't. I mean, they were like 100% across the board, and yet the Democrats have a completely different pose. So it's two issues. It's the big ethical, moral, what's right issue, and then the trying to understand the feebleness of the Democratic Party's like posture.
Oh, the Democratic Party. the constant question. You know, I think with the polling on this is, as you pointed out, was really strong. On the DACA issue, almost 90% of the public is on the side of the Dreamers. Even some like 78% of Republicans are on the side of the Dreamers. So that's a very strong base to build from, a national consensus, really. But what they weren't on the side of was shutting down the government for that. And so I'm sure the Democrats were doing daily, probably multi times a day, polling to try to sense where the public mood was going. And I have no doubt that their decision was made because they sensed that public was going against them on the shutdown for the DACA amendment changes. Now we're back on new turf. It's no longer about the shutdown. It's completely about the Dreamers and the wall. And on those two fronts, you know, our side has the vote, has a national consensus.
It's an important point, I think.
Yeah.
That's an important point.
You know, and there's immediacy to this, too, because while members of Congress are spinning their wheels and speechifying, Donald Trump's Immigration and Customs Enforcement is raiding stores and restaurants. They're arresting undocumented workers, and not even just undocumented workers. There was a piece in today's Washington Post saying that a medical doctor in Kalamazoo, Michigan, who has been in the United States for 40 years, he came here as something like 10-year-old or 5-year-old.
Child.
He doesn't even speak Polish, has been arrested and is in jail right now awaiting deportation because 26 years ago he had two minor arrests that have since been expunged from his record. That's just an example of what the Trump administration is doing all across the country. So while Democrats twiddle their thumbs and hope for the best that something good is going to happen in February, these sweeps are taking place all across the country.
Go ahead, Angie.
I mean, I think I've definitely, you know, set this time and time again. You know, we definitely have some issues with the congressional leaders in terms of, you know, not being able to pass any comprehensive or logical legislative piece in the, you know, for a really long time. But we also have, you know, the current administration to deal with. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty with the House at the moment. I mean, President Trump is as unpredictable as he comes. And, you know, the larger issue with his administration is that he is not a politician in a sense of he's looking at the issues of policies and systemic fault. His agenda, I've said this many, many times over, his agendas are very clear that they're rooted in white supremacy, xenophobia, anti-immigrant, roots, and it's. I don't think that anyone should even doubt that this fact, and so it's not surprising to me that although he'll go back and forth on his decisions about where he stands on how we should fix the immigration system and how we can protect the Dreamers, he's going off, you know, throwing innocent people out of the country, arresting innocent people with absolutely no grounds. He has issued a Muslim ban about four times. And he has attacked, you know, undocumented immigrant communities time and time again. There is absolutely no question that this administration stands for, white supremacist agenda. He wants to what we call, push forward an ethnic cleansing and rid of innocent people who's been living here and has lives that are deeply rooted for decades. So I think that there's absolutely no question or surprise there for me.
Angie Kim is correct. I mean, when you hear Donald Trump speak in an unscripted way, you know, whether it was in that meeting at the White House where he's talking about Haitians and people in Africa and people in El Salvador in the most disparaging terms, that was unscripted. Or when he had the unscripted press conference after Charlottesville, where he couldn't contain himself, so very, very fine people on both sides, meaning amongst the Nazis. And all of the other comments, the fact that he took out a full-page ad in the 1980s calling for the execution of five black teenagers, the Central Park Five, who turned out to be innocent of the allegation that they had raped a white woman at Central Park. I mean, when you look at the whole thing with Trump, he is, in a visceral way, a white supremacist. I mean, that's who Donald Trump is. Kevin Zees, jump in.
Well, there's truth in that, but there's also truth to remember that Obama is still the record deporter in chief. Trump has not broken Obama's records yet for a year of deportation. So let's not give the Democrats a Trump bypass, you know, because as bad as Trump is, the Democrats have a history. And I think it's also interesting to see that in this vote today, the power that the Dreamers have in that every presidential candidate for the Democrats in 2020 voted on the side of the Dreamers, insisting that DACA...
Meaning they voted no.
They voted no. They wanted DACA fixed before they ended the government shutdown. So I think that's a sign of political power. And so really our task now is to build on that power. We have national consensus on our side. We have a clock ticking to February 8th. They have to resolve this or go back in another shutdown. That'll be another embarrassment right around the time of the State of the Union for Trump to deal with. So this is, we still have power here. We shouldn't underestimate our power. I think we need to build on this, the power that we have. We have national consensus. Every significant Democrat running for 2020 president, time on our side, that shows the power we have on that side, of the duopoly.
Good points from Kevin Zees. And of course, Angie, you know, when we think back of all the struggles for civil rights and all the struggles for justice, there are so many disappointments. I mean, they outnumber the victories by, you know, by the magnitude of thousands, actually, because people are fighting, and it's rare that actual victories are achieved. But when they are achieved, it's because the people themselves have become somehow a factor in the political equation that can't be ignored by even the most conservative politicians. That was certainly true in the case of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The composition of the U.S. Congress in 1964 was just the same as it was in 1954 when it was upholding apartheid in the southern states of the United States. What changed was the people changed, the people mobilized, the people became a factor. I think Kevin's words are well taken. You're there, though, Angie. You're amongst the Dreamers and with the Dreamers, and you've gone through all the ups and downs and ups and downs. I mean, it's like an amazing story of resilience, and yet, you know, I just want to ask you, is the mood there right now? Is it fired up, or is it overcome with depression?
You know, it's definitely has been a tough month. You know, I had just arrived back in New York from DC yesterday. You know, alongside my fellow Dreamers, we spent a week in DC meeting with senators and legislators, sharing our story, and it is emotionally very, very taxing. It's emotionally draining, and we are exhausted. However, you know, we persevere because that's what immigrants do. And immigrants, you know, are the backbone of this country, as I've said. And we understood that there will be many hurdles and challenges, and we still do. And we, you know, in no way do we take this momentum as a failure. I think we actually see it as a success. We, you know, we've had a wonderful week of action. We've, you know, had impactful, you know, meetings and conversations with legislators where we've seen them actually literally change their vote and come around. I mean, I've shared tears with, I met with Senator Durbin yesterday and we've shared tears stories of our family. So, you know, there are wins and losses, throughout this process. But I think overall, you know, we are, you know, definitely hopeful. We are not going to give up. We're going to keep fighting. And that is, you know, what immigrants stands for and what they symbolize is a relentlessness, their tenacity and their perseverance and the strength that they have and the belief that they have in their community and their power is so strong that I truly believe that it will resonate throughout the country, through, you know, the Congress. And it's just a matter of time for people before people realizes that they are that they want to side on the right side of the justice. But, it's about the time and when of all of these manifestation. But I definitely believe in my community, and I'm not giving up.
That was the voice of Angie Kim. We're also talking with Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of PopularResistance.org. Angie is an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minquan Center. We have about 3.5-4 minutes left. Angie, just in a minute or so, because I want to make sure that our audience, which may be hearing our show and you for the first time, understands the human side to this, because it's not just about big politics. Just talk very briefly about, because you have before, but I want you to do it again, if you would, about your own story. When did you come to the United States? And if you're deported, where would you go?
Absolutely. I came to the country when I was 9 years old with my family. I currently live in what we call a mixed-status family, and I'm something of a product of the broken immigration system in this country. My parents tried to adjust our status, and they failed. When my grandmother, who was a sponsor for my family, passed away in the process, that put me in a permanent, what we call a backlog, and I've been undocumented since. I received my first DACA approval when I was 29 years old. So I almost didn't make it. And it has changed my life. And here I am fighting for my community. And, you know, I've lived here, you know, for the most part of the last 34 years of my life. I have no other place to go. This is my home, which is true for me and true for so many other dreamers, here in the country. And that will not change. It's a matter of the rest of the country and our congressional leaders and the leaders of this country for them to realize that. I'm humbled, and I'm a grateful activist who is just, happy to be part of this movement.
That's Angie Kim. Kevin Zeese, we have just under 2 minutes. I mean, I think it's important. We have Angie as an immigrant, as an undocumented dreamer, fighting for her rights. But obviously the dreamers and the undocumented in the immigrant community should not, and in fact are not, fighting alone, even though for them it may sometimes feel that way. Kevin Zeese, you're not an immigrant. Well, not right now. You were born here. What's the message to the native born people in the United States?
Well, I think Angie's a great spokesperson. I like everything she said about what her group stands for and what she stands for. And I think her personal story is the most important thing for all dreamers to tell, that kind of story, so people can really have a human-to-human contact. And I think it's important to remember that the Republicans in the House are running scared. You have a record number of chairmen of committees who are dropping out and not running again. And those are people who are in the safe seats, who get reelected and reelected, and they're dropping out and not running again. And so they're looking at losing control of the House. They're looking at a massive wave of votes against them. And I think the more that the human stories of Angie and others are told, the stronger the national consensus will get in the favor of dreamers. And I think that's really what has to be done. I think you got to focus on some key members of Congress who are nervous about the election and get them to switch sides, and that will create the kind of avalanche we need in the House to get what we need. Once we get the Senate and the House on our side, Trump will not be alone on this. He will not risk it. It will be too negative for him to. And so I think this is very winnable. I don't think I can understand being despondent after this vote today, but I hope that's temporary and we can get back to work again and make this happen, because it's an injustice. And it's injustice that's resolved.
A gross miscarriage of justice. I agree with you. I agree with both of you. And I want to thank both of you. We've been joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese, the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. Go to popularresistance.org to read his writings and other writings of that staff. And we've been joined from New York by dreamer Angie Kim, an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minquan Center for Community Action. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Turkish forces have captured the Syrian city of Afrin on the third day of an offensive to oust Syrian Kurdish fighters from the border. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. And we're joined from Beirut by independent political analyst and journalist Marwa Osman. Welcome to both of you.
Brian, John, thanks for having me. Always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Likewise here. Thank you for having us.
Thank you both for joining. These are big developments. Mark, let's start with you. We have, even though it's 30 minutes, it'll go fast. So let's just briefly, especially for our audience here in Washington that may not be paying careful attention or sadly getting all of its information from the corporate-owned media that functions as an echo chamber for the Pentagon, just help us and our audience understand what exactly has happened in the last few days.
Yeah, well, first of all, the low-hanging fruit of ISIS has largely been militarily defeated, particularly in East Syria. This has led to a tense situation. The conflict is nowhere near ending. We're now facing a three-way Mexican standoff between Russia and the Syrian government, Turkey and its proxies, which at this point include what was once the Free Syrian Army, Ahrar al-Sham, and al-Qaeda's iteration, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. And on the other side is the United States and its proxies, which contain the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are majority Kurdish YPG, the People's Protection Units. The situation has boiled down because the U.S. announced that it was going to build a 30,000-strong border force. Then it changed it to a stabilization force. They changed the name back and forth to try to assuage Turkey. But they announced that they are going to permanently and indefinitely military occupy East Syria, continuing the fight against ISIS, the remnants of ISIS, to make sure they don't come back. But also they insisted on regime change in Damascus and that they're there to counter Iranian influence in the country, as if Syria doesn't have the right to say who its allies are and who they aren't. Turkey was upset by the announcement of this continuation of this force and with the heavy weapons that the U.S. has sent in. And they have made loud moves towards both the East and the West, particularly now in the West, towards a small Kurdish canton, Afrin, on the Turkish border, a mountainous area that is nearly on more than three sides surrounded by Turkey or al-Qaeda and the other Turkish proxies. It's in a really tight situation. Evidently, Russia and the Syrian government went to Afrin and they said to the Kurds there, they said, if you'll raise the Syrian flag and allow the Syrian army in, recognize that we're your government and whatever our political difficulties, then we can protect you. The Kurds said no. And that was basically the green light that Turkey needed, to the pretext. And they have launched a large military operation headed up by their proxies, but accompanied with a large amount of air power, tanks, and others. And they've given every indication that they intend to cleanse Afrin of Kurds.
Okay, let's bring Marwa Osman into the discussion. Marwa, do you agree with Mark? How do you see it?
Well, yes, that's exactly how it happened, as Mark just said, with the obvious role of the Turkey that has been going on, that the Turks, Erdogan himself, has been actually going on through the fact that he wants to get his boots inside of Syrian soil for more than 6 months now. Now he has the chance to do so. He is doing so. He has been now already 5 kilometers inside of the Syrian territory. He plans to make it a 30-kilometer line for him, to a protection line, which he likes to call a protection line within the Syrian territory, which basically is a sort of occupation. It is an occupation. This is what he has in mind in Afrin, especially on three major villages which are Shinar. Shinar is in the northeastern part of Afrin, and Bulbul, which is on the deep north, and then you have Rajo, which is on the north, the west, northwestern part of Afrin as well. So majorly, this is how it's going to go, because the YPG units, which I personally refuse to call them the Syrian Democratic Forces, because they're not. They are a proxy force for the US. They've been funded, given weapons by the U.S., and they have lately since last month, in the third of last month, when they had a meeting with the Russian certain Russian military men, trying to persuade them to allow the Syrian army to get in there and try to protect them. They refused. So basically, they have no one there to help them, despite the fact that there was some sort of a corridor opened between the eastern part of Syria towards Afrin. It was some sort of a corridor that the Syrian government opened with the help of the Russians for more Kurdish forces, if I may, to enter Afrin and fight along with their Kurdish allies in Afrin against the Turkish side and against FSA. But at the same time, Turkey has air power. Turkey has we all know that the U.S. will not allow any sort of air power, U.S. air power to enter that territory, because they were very clear that they will stay on the eastern part of the Euphrates. They won't go. Their operations do not include the western part of the Euphrates. So there you go. They're not going to get any help from their main backer, from their main ally, the U.S. forces, who now, as Mark said, they plan to remain as occupiers in the eastern part of the Euphrates, which is Syrian territory. So now you have a Syrian territory taken by the U.S. and the eastern side of Euphrates, and now Turkey has decided to enter, and they have in mind to create some sort of a 30-kilometer area where they have their boots on the ground inside of Syrian territory, because it is very clear that within Erdogan's plan, he literally wants to clean the entire area from the people living there, which are majorly Kurds. So as well as the fact that there are certain political dilemmas or a political deadlock between the Kurds, the residing in Afrin, and the Syrian government. But at the same time, we heard President Bashar Assad being very firm about the fact that this is a Turkish invasion. This is unacceptable. Whatever that is that's going on there, it should not be happening, because this has to be a part of a political solution between the government and the YPG forces in Afrin. So that has nothing to do with Erdogan. It's way above his territorial or security, or within his means of operation. It's within Syrian territory. So it is a bit complicated, but at the same time, I won't deny the fact that it is something that maybe would have a positive effect or a positive result for the Syrian government on the political side in Sochi. Because let the enemies fight, because at the same time, these both enemies are at some point also enemies of the Syrian government, despite the fact that these are Syrians and these are Turks. But at the end of the day, let them fight off, because whether they like it or not, this is Syrian territory. And at the end of the day, it will be part of the Syrian government's territory.
Marwa, let me jump in. And I want to sort of frame a question and bring it back to Mark and to you. Yes, this is Syrian territory, no doubt. But a lot of international forces are deeply engaged. We have In the past, we had Russia, Iran, and Turkey functioning as the guarantors for a peace process. Earlier than that, it was Geneva, which wasn't a peace process. It was just a regime change process that collapsed. But here we have, it appears, different sides perhaps sort of mixing it up and the constellation of forces being rearranged once again. And I want to make sure that we're hearing you properly when you say that the Russians and the Syrian government went amongst the Kurds in Afrin and asked them to raise the flag of the Syrian government. And under those circumstances, they would come in and support the Kurds against any Turkish offensive. And the Kurds said no. Now, I'm looking at another website called MiddleEastEye.net. And here's the headline: pro-Kurdish forces condemn Russian betrayal as Afrin operation continues. And as you read the article, the Kurdish forces are arguing, quote, We had certain arrangements with Russia, but Russia suddenly disregarded these agreements and betrayed us. They have clearly sold us out. If that's not true, what would the Kurdish calculation be? They're facing overwhelming forces from Turkey. If they're not being supported by Russia or Syria, were they counting? Are you suggesting that they were counting on Americans to come in and support them against a Turkish offensive, and then the Americans switched their position, as appeared to happen when Tillerson said over the weekend, you know, we understand Turkey's position. We understand it. First, Mark, and then Marwa, let's go quickly through this. I just want to make sure we're actually hearing you properly.
Yes, that is exactly the situation as it stands. It is a little bit complicated situation. The Kurds are not a monolith in Syria. The Afrin Canton Kurds to the west have always been more aligned with the Syrian government and Russia. They have received supplies, they have received arms, they have cooperated in various ventures. But with the Kurds in the east of the country increasingly falling under the wing of the United States, who has evidently made them a lot of unrealistic promises about statehood, which none of the regional countries, Iraq, Turkey, Syria, Iran, would ever accept or agree to. This has led to this tense situation. Russia actually had about 300 military police that were maintaining a peacekeeping function in Afrin. When the Kurds denied, the Afrin Kurds denied the Russian and the Syrian request to bring in the Syrian army to take border control of the area, you know, raise the flag, Russia pulled these troops out of Afrin. And they also moved the reconciliation center that was at the air base there. What my understanding is that the Kurdish commander basically relied that the U.S. would come to their rescue, as the U.S. has backed the Kurds in eastern Syria. Obviously, this didn't happen. The Kurds do feel betrayed. Damascus feels betrayed. Russia feels betrayed. Turkey feels betrayed. The U.S. feels betrayed. Everyone feels betrayed in this tense, again, this three-way standoff that has emerged. Russia is making somewhat of a cold geopolitical choice here. They would rather see the Turks and the U.S. and their proxies fight each other. The U.S. would like to see the same thing. They would like to see Turkey and Russia, this Astana agreement, as fragile as it is, fall apart completely. It's nearly already there anyway, with Turkey's continuing support of al-Qaeda. They're actually literally doing joint patrols with al-Qaeda and arming al-Qaeda on Afrin's borders. So the Astana agreement, as far as I'm concerned, is really pretty much a fiction at this point. But the U.S.'s announcement of that they're not leaving and they're building the stabilization force has actually given it the possibility of resuscitating the Astana agreement, if only because the Turks might be more angry at the Americans at this point than at the Russians. But rather than going towards east, towards Manbij, they've chosen Afrin first, which Russia really didn't want. The Syrian government is still allowing troops, Kurdish troops, to move from the east through their territory towards Afrin, and both the Syrian and the Iranian presidents have spoken condemning this. This is actually the second invasion and occupation of Syrian territory by Erdogan's regime in Turkey, the first one being the Jarablus Triangle.
Mark, I'd like to ask you, and I'd also like to ask Marwa, a very simple question, not just for our listeners, but for me. I'm actually having trouble understanding, what exactly are U.S. interests in Syria? I mean, I understand these pronouncements from the State Department and from the Pentagon that the policy is regime change, but that's not a national interest. So what exactly do you think the United States hopes to accomplish?
Go ahead, Marwa.
This is, Brian, what I wanted to talk about, because when Mark's words, when he said that the YPG, the Kurdish units, were relying on some sort of an aid coming from the U.S., if they actually had that in mind, they would, for me, I would say that they're literally out of their minds. If they don't know how the U.S. works by now, that's a disaster. Because if you look at why would the U.S. be interested in a friend? They're not. They're interested in the area where there is a lot of resources. And when I say a lot of resources, I mean oil and gas. And if you look at Deir ez-Zor and the eastern part of the Euphrates, there is where the gas and oil resides. The huge oil pipelines and the huge oil fields for Syria and the gas fields as well are situated where the U.S. wants to stay, where the U.S. wouldn't allow anyone to maybe step forward, because we saw a lot of bickering when Deir ez-Zor was about to fall, and the Kurds also had in mind that, well, we're going to have the help of the U.S. and we're going to take Deir ez-Zor back, and that did not happen. But what happened is that they took control of the eastern part of the Euphrates and what is called, what is known as the valley, the Euphrates Valley. And the Euphrates Valley has is very rich with resources, and that's where the U.S. wants to stay. I mean, I could tell you in specific numbers what the U.S. wants. I mean, there's certain fields in there in the eastern part of Deir ez-Zor and the Furat Valley, where a lot of U.S. interest resides, that could go off to more than 25% of the territory, let's say, under the control of the Kurds, that could provide a vital economic source for them to actually operate as a federation, or if you will, as a state. But that's not basically possible now. But in the future, if they can remain in that area economically, they can survive as a independent entity. In that specific area, you have let me just try and find the numbers that I want to talk to you about. So I would be very specific. We're talking about thousands of tons of gas that it's more than 130 million cubic foot of gas and more than 1,000 ton of domestic gas. This was all being operated by the Syrian government before it fell under the Kurdish territory, and now it's under direct U.S. Influence and security or occupation. So this is where the U.S. is residing. This is the interest of the U.S. Why would they care about a friend? The only way that they would care about a friend if it had any sort of a national interest for the U.S., and it doesn't. It's only a part, it's a historic part for the Kurds, and it's at the same time a very vital point for Erdogan to try and clear in order to secure his own land, because we all know that the YPG is the Syrian part of the PKK, which definitely Erdogan hates and sees as terrorists.
Hear you on that. We hear you on that. And that's extremely useful information. So again, for our audience, if you look at a map and you see the northern part of Syria, which is constitutes the southern border with Turkey, in the western part where the Turkish military has gone in, that's in Afrin, there's Azaz, Jarablus, Manbij, further out. And these are the areas that go all the way to the Euphrates River. And then east of the Euphrates River, but also in the northern part of Syria, is where the Syrian Democratic Forces, so-called the YPG, the Kurdish forces, along with American military forces, still dominate. And Mar was talking about that area of Syria being very, very resource rich, and thus possibly constituting the foundation for the viability of a Kurdish or semi-independent Kurdish state.
That is believable. I think that Marwa's position is entirely plausible.
Now, that might be possible if this fledgling Kurdish de facto statelet had the capability of getting that energy out of the area. They don't. They certainly can't take it through Syrian territory. They can't take it through Turkish territory. Iraq is not happy about them either. You know, the U.S. is estranging its NATO ally, Turkey, as well as the government that it installed in Iraq. They don't have anywhere to take it. I think it's more about denying those resources the capability to restore economic capability and rebuilding that they want to deny to the Syrian government in Damascus. Now, John, when you talk national interest, what is in the national interest of the U.S., you're thinking too small. You don't have the same conception of national interests as the neocons that are now running the Trump administration's policy.
You're undoubtedly right.
Yeah, they're thinking hegemonic global interests, right? And in the region, in the Middle East, that's conflated with the interests of Saudi Arabia and Israel. The U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel is the tripod for control of the region. And their greatest adversary is Iran. And the neocon geopoliticians are all obsessed with this arc of Shiite influence that now spreads through Iran, Iraq, after the disastrous U.S. removal of Saddam Hussein there that caused the backlash against them and actually increased Iranian influence through Syria, southern Lebanon, and into the Mediterranean Ocean. When Trump wanted, when he campaigned, he wanted to end regime change, he said. He wanted to stop nation building. He wanted to stop the euphemism of democracy promotion. He specifically said that Hillary Clinton would mess around in Syria and try to get us involved in World War III. So the neocons, the Brookings Institute, and others, as soon as Trump won the election, they openly talked that they wanted to shift tactics. Instead of talking Russia, 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 because Trump, at least in the beginning, wanted detente with Russia, they would talk Iran, 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 because there were a lot of Iran hawks in the Trump administration, and there are even more now than there were before. So this is how they sold all of this, and this is one of the major reasons that Tillerson and the head of the U.S. anti-Daesh mission there in the U.S. military occupation of eastern Syria mentioned they're there to counter Iranian influence. This is a very nebulous idea. Iran, of course, had influence in Syria before this. Their presence there is not going to stop Syria from allying with Iran. So it's really more of a part of a token geopolitical presence. But at the same time, I think it's a great deal of this is just spite. Their regime change efforts have been stopped. So they want to deny a full territorial integrity restoration of Syria to Russia and to the Syrian government and its allies, including Iran. They would rather keep the area destabilized and unable to reconstitute itself politically or economically. They see that as a plan B to fall back on.
Let me ask both of you a question, and we'll start back with Marwa. I mean, and this would undoubtedly have to be a judgment based on the relationship of forces. But if Turkey sort of defeats the Kurds in the western, northwestern part of Syria, which they appear to have the capability of doing, will the Syrian Arab army, the Syrian government, and its allies, Iran and Russia, use military means to try to liberate the other part of Syria that's under the control of the Syrian Democratic Forces, or YPG, the Kurds, who have U.S. backing? Would there be a military clash in the northeastern part of Syria, or will Russia and Iran just sort of acclimate to the idea that the U.S. has created its own sphere of influence within the country?
No, look, it's a bit more complicated than this. It's not an either or. We understand that any upcoming solution that's going to have to happen for Syria is going to have to include all the players on one table, whether they like it or not. The Syrian government has already taken control of the vast swaths of land of the Syrian state. So basically, you just have these couple of places which are Evren and the eastern part of the Euphrates, because of the Evren part, because of Erdogan's I don't know how to call it, but he's a very stiff man. He doesn't want to get it through his head that this is Syrian territory. He should not be there. But at the same time, the Russians are leaving him to do what, like they let him go do and whatever they want him to do, just to make sure that they would get the acceptance of the Kurds there, that they have no one to defend them except of the Syrian Arab army and the Russian forces as well. Now, what's happening on the eastern side, that's something that's entirely different. And the eastern side of the Euphrates, where the U.S. has the say of what happens, whether the Kurds have a deadlock, political deadlock with the government or not, they still have a say in that, despite the fact that up until now, we haven't seen any sort of a direct confrontation between the Syrian government and the YPG in the sense that it is a vast and huge thing. We did see that a bit in Deir ez-Zor while Deir ez-Zor was getting liberated, but it ended within 8 days. The clashes stopped because it is very complicated. It's very difficult to enter such a complicated war because we know the U.S. will engage with its air force, which would make it a huge deal for the Russians as well. Because at the end of the day, these two powerful states, Russia and the U.S., they are fighting one another with their proxies, whether we like it or not, inside of Syria. Yes, it is the Syrian government and Syrian Arab army being an ally of Russia, but at the end of the day, we are seeing two major enemies fighting on Syrian land. Now, your question is, can we actually see them engage directly to try and liberate the eastern part of the Euphrates? I'll have to say no, because whether or not the U.S. stays in that area, it has to go down to a political solution. It cannot go through a genocide on either side because it's inhabited with civilians, it's Kurds and Syrians on the other side. At the same time, it's for no one's interest. No one really wants to fight this sort of war. They are now trying to put their feet down on the ground before the big political break. And I think that big political break will not include indefinitely the presence of the U.S., but maybe the presence of the U.S. influence in that specific region. That has to do with how long the what we call it in Arabic, the nafas, how long the breath, who has the longest breath to grasp the ground and the influence on the ground in order to take it politically. At the end of the day, this is Syria. I mean, look what happened for the U.S. in Iraq. After how many years, and they were still not welcome, and up till now, they are still not welcome. Does the U.S. really think, the neocons really think, that if they have the power, the military power and the money for it, that the people at the end of the day will just accept them, even if they were Kurds? The Kurds want to operate in their own territory. They want to rule. At the end of the day, they don't want the U.S. to stay there forever. They just want the influence and the backing of the U.S. So no, a war, I don't think that's likely, but yes, a grasp for more political power in that region.
Okay, 1 minute left. Mark Sloboda, you get the last word.
Yeah, I don't think, certainly there isn't the intention for a direct military conflict. We have, of course, already seen scattered skirmishes, airstrikes, and everything, but Russia is doing a very complicated geopolitical dance to avoid a direct confrontation either with the Turkish regime or with the U.S., both which are military occupying parts of Syria. Mistakes can happen. They would rather have them fight each other, or they hope the U.S. will eventually tire of the expense and the bother. They're not going to spend any reconstruction funds, see that their options are limited, perhaps a little bit of guerrilla warfare, insurgent operations within U.S. occupied territory, and eventually withdraw, not willing to station thousands of U.S. troops in yet another Middle East country, you know, outside the boundaries of international law. I think that's what Russia is counting on. Eventually, the Americans will leave. They're just trying to give them time and an exit ramp.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. And we've been joined from Beirut by independent political analyst and journalist Marwa Osman. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back with the top stories of the day. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.